Hello and welcome to the Standardized System for Access and Disclosure Operational Design Phase Project Update webinar, being held on Thursday, the 18th of November, 2021 at 1600 UTC. My name is Andrea Glandon and I am the Remote Participation Manager for this session. Please note that this session is being recorded and follows the ICANN expected standards of behavior. During this session, questions or comments will only be read aloud if submitted within the Q&A pod. They will be read aloud at the end of the presentation. Interpretation for this session will include English, French, Spanish, Russian, Arabic, and Chinese. I will place instructions in the chat on how to connect to the other languages via telephone. All participants in this session may make comments in the chat. Please use the drop-down menu in the chat pod and select everyone. This will allow everyone to view your comment. Please note that private chats are only possible among panelists in the Zoom webinar format. Any message sent by a panelist or a standard attendee to another standard attendee will also be seen by the session's hosts, co-hosts, and other panelists. With that, I will turn the floor over to Yuko Yokoyama. Please begin.
Thank you, Andrea. Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Yuko Yokoyama, and I am the program director from the Strategic Initiative Team within Global Domains and Strategy Function. The Strategic Initiative Team is responsible for leading the first operational design phase, ODP, that ICANN is conducting. This ODP is for EPDP Phase 2's consensus policy recommendations for an SAD, or System for Standardized Access and Disclosure. Quick reminder about this ODP. The project team is developing a draft design to help inform the board's consideration of the SAD-related recommendations. The design we are sharing today, and eventually in Operational Design Assessment, ODA, which is our final deliverable for this effort, are the starting point for implementation should the board adopt the recommendations. In other words, what you see today is not the end of the discussion on how we may tackle some of these complex design choices, but rather the beginning of a longer conversation if and when ICANN org begins implementation of an SAD. We want to share these designs with you now so we can hear from you on our approach, proposed approach. This is our fourth project status update webinar on SAD ODP, and I'm glad you were able to join us today. The project team has been working tirelessly since the beginning of the ODP and have been making substantial progress on their analysis every day. As promised during our last webinar in October, during the ICANN 72, we are today sharing our recommendations on how the system and business process could be designed. We will also share a quick update on our survey of GAC members regarding governmental accreditation. As stated during the last webinar, more analysis we do, more questions pop up. It is important for us to share our designs and assumptions so we can ask for your feedback and input on our design choices. Today's topic is rather big and also a very important one. We posted the presentation deck on our webpage to provide opportunity for people to digest the content prior to the webinar, in case anybody was interested. It is already available at ICANN.org/SADODP. As usual, we will have a Q&A at the end of the presentation, and we'd like to hear from you then. We also welcome any feedback if you think of anything after the webinar ended. You can send us an email at our publicly archived inbox at odp-sad@icann.org. Okay, let's get started. Next slide, please. So here you see today's agenda, and as stated before, it is light in terms of number of topics, but really packed content. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Thank you. So as you may recall, we issued a survey to GAC during the summer, and the deadline was actually extended twice to solicit more participation. It is now closed. It actually closed on October 31st. The GAC survey included three main questions and nine optional questions intended to collect further input relevant to the implementation of the recommendation two and the way a government and territory would engage with FSAP. The three questions are these. First, which country and territory are you representing? And second, how should each country and territory or government designated accreditation authority be designated to ICANN.org or its designee? And the third is, who in your administration should be authorized to make such designations? The survey yielded about, we actually received 16 responses with three duplicates, hence a total of 13 unique responses. Out of the 13 unique responses, three countries and territories only provided their names, and three countries and territories provided answers to those that are of that three main questions only, and seven countries and territories responded to all 12 questions. We're analyzing the responses as of right now, but we have reached out to GAC to brief them on results. Next slide, please. And now I will hand it over to Francisco Arias, Senior Director of GDS Technical Services. Francisco, please.
Thank you, Yuko. So now we are going to be covering the business process design of the ESAT. If you attended the previous webinar during ICANN 72, my colleague Aaron covered the design choices for the identity verification process. In this section of the webinar, which is the biggest portion of it, we will be talking about the rest of the design for the ESAT. Next slide, please. So first, some numbers of the overall, what we end up discovering or designing in this system. We discovered that we need to have consider eight different types of actors, so entities that will be playing a role, for example, requestors, accreditation authorities, contract parties, etc. We're going to be talking about those shortly. We also discovered that we need to have eight different subsystems, so systems that play a role within the ESAT. The ESAT as a it's a complex system. It's a system that is composed of multiple different systems that interact with each other in order to be able to provide the functioning that is described in the policy recommendations. So for example, here you will see the contract parties. They need to provide a system that is used for disclose the data for a request that has been approved. You need a system in the central gateway to route the different the requests and measure the SLAs and things like that, and so on and so forth. We are going to also be discussing each of the subsystems at a high level. And finally, another interesting data point is the business processes. We discover 60 processes that need to be put in place. These refer to each of the different interactions that need to happen between the actors and the systems. For example, one process is to have a user accredited, for example. That's a big one. That is, again, what's covered in the previous webinar. But there are also other smaller processes that are being discovered, for example, for a contract party to be able to set their preference or settings with the central gateway in order to be able to integrate with the different systems or to provide some preference that are needed in order for the system to work. So and things like that. So we discovered, like I said, 60 different processes that need to be put in place, and some big, some small. It's a little bit of everything in that. Because of limitations of time, we are not going to be able to discuss all the business processes. We are only going to be covering the big ones, the most important ones. Next slide, please. So the actors, like I said, there are 8 different actors that we discover that need to be part of the ESAT. I said 60 different business processes, 60, Amer. So for the actors, we have first, of course, the requesters, the people that will be asking for the data. And these, as discussed in the previous webinar, they are divided in 2 main categories. First, the non-governmental persons that can be either natural or legal persons. So it can be an individual asking for the data, or it can be, say, a corporation that is asking for the data. But the main driver here is that they are non-governmental. You will see later why we are making a differentiation if you didn't see that in our previous webinar. The second category is the governmental entities and intergovernmental organizations. Now, the second actor we have here is the accreditation authorities. Know the plural here. We have 2 types of accreditation authorities. We have one that is going to be, that will have to be set up by ICANN as described in the policy recommendation. We're calling it the Central Accreditation Authority. For lack of a better name, that's not the name that is used in the policy recommendation, but it thought it would make sense to call it that. The Central Accreditation Authority is the one that will be serving the non-governmental, natural, and legal persons, while the country and territory governmental accreditation authorities, they will be serving the governmental and intergovernmental organizations. And for those, there can be one per each country or territory. So there can be many playing in the ESAT. The tier actor is the central gateway. This is an entity contracted by ICANN. They are the ones that route the central gateway is the one that route the requests as received from the requesters and pass it to the accreditation of to the contract parties for them to make the decision where the request should be approved or not, and then they receive data from the contract parties to be able to do the SLAs, to measure the SLAs, and a few other things. So more on that later. We have something that we call the abuse investigator. This is a specific function that it's intended to take care of investigating complaints of potential abuse by requesters. So if a contract party or someone else complains that a requester is potentially doing something that they should not in the ESAT, then this entity, the abuse investigator, will be in charge of investigating that. They will also be receiving periodic data dumps from the central gateway regarding the number of requests made by requesters, etc. But we're going to be talking more in more detail about the abuse investigations later in the presentation. Another actor is obviously the contract parties, the registries and registrars, GTLD registries and registrars, of course. This is a policy aimed at the GTLD space, not CCTLDs or others. They are the ones that have a dual role here. They are the authorizers, so the entities that decide if requests has to be can be approved or not, and also they are the ones that if the request was approved, they disclose the data directly to the requester, and we're going to be talking more on how that is going to work later. Then we have the auditors. The auditors are the obviously the parties that audit, independent auditors of 2 parties in particular. There is more detail on that later, but very quickly the auditors will be auditing the Central Accreditation Authority, optionally the governmental accreditation authorities, and the data subjects. The requesters, apologies for that. Then we have the data subjects, they are the next actor. They are the registrants, the parties which personal data could be being disclosed in ESAT if approved. And lastly, we have ICANN.org, who also plays a role as, for example, the compliance team. They will be looking at potential abuse or non-compliance actions from contract parties, and also receiving complaints from data subjects. Next slide, please. So accreditation authorities, I'm not going to be talking too much about this since it was covered by Aaron in the past in terms of what the role is. They will be the ones that verify the requester's identity. If someone wants to play in ESAT, if someone wants to get data, they need to be to have their identity verified before they can do that. One thing that may surprise some is that when we were looking at the design, we first started thinking that the request will go directly from requesters to the central gateway, and but that will put the requesters in having to interact with two different entities, the accreditation authorities in order to be accredited, and then the central gateway in order to make the request, and potentially having to pay bills in both sides. So we thought that was not the best user experience for the requesters, and we look at the policy and thought it was not necessarily required, or it was not forbidden for the accreditation authorities to be the one interface. So that's what we are proposing, that the requesters are the requesters interact only with the accreditation authorities, even for the submission of disclosure requests. And then the accreditation authorities will simply forward that request to the central gateway, who then will do the routing and, again, everything else that needs to be done with the request. So requesters are only going to be talking with accreditation authorities in order to have them be accredited to manage their disclosure requests. The accreditation authorities also will be the ones that will be doing the authentication of a requester on behalf of the central gateway and the contract parties. More on that later. They are going to be doing the billing so that we will be making the life of the requesters easier. It's the only place where they will need to pay if there are any fees that need to be paid. The accreditation authorities, per the policy recommendations, have the option to delegate some functions to what is called in the policy recommendation identity providers. This is, by the way, a term that is used with a very different meaning in other places. Good thing in the design, we are avoiding the use of identity providers. In general, we're treating the identity providers as we will treat the resellers in the case of a registrar. For those of you that are familiar with that, the registrars, we deem them basically responsible for whatever happens there. It doesn't matter if it's done directly by them or the resellers. In this case, we're following that same design approach. The accreditation authorities are responsible for whatever happens. It doesn't matter if they are doing this directly or if they are relying on some identity provider to do some function for them. Finally, the governmental accreditation authorities, they will be, they are obviously designated by the government of the respective country or territory. And one important thing here is we are thinking they are going to be using exactly the same interface to integrate with the central gateway and the contract parties. So it doesn't matter if this is the central accreditation authority or any of the governmental accreditation authorities. They are going to be using, they are going to have to implement the same interfaces in order to integrate into the system. Next slide, please. We identified four different contracts or categories of contracts that need to be put in place. I think a couple of them or three of them are no surprises. We need a central accreditation authority that need to be put in place by ICANN. They will have to develop systems and manage operations and a process in place in order to do the function. I think we cover some of that and more on some other functions later. We then have what in the policy recommendations are called the central gateway manager. We are dividing that those functions in two, or put it in the way that is described in the policy recommendations. We're assuming, we're having ICANN assume the role of the central gateway manager and then outsource most of the functions to an entity called Central Gateway, which we took care to put all the automated functions in there. So for this, we'll be looking for someone that does system development and operations of that system, and they don't need to set up any processes, manual processes or anything like that. So this is something that we could potentially, if we were to get to implementation, we could probably put an RFP and a contract someone that is a specialist in developing systems, which we think there are plenty out there. Number three, it's the abuse investigator. I talked briefly about this. They are going to be investigating a potential abuse from requesters and only from requesters, correct parties that is investigated by compliance, of course. Number four is the auditors, and the auditors will be auditing the Central Accreditation Authority. We're going to offer that to the governmental accreditation authorities at no cost, that the same auditor will do the audit for them. And here, they are going to be auditing requesters. And here, it's important to mention that audit of requesters is not intended to... it's not like the audit will be on the finances of the requester if a company is asking for data, if they are a requester. It's merely about the data that is submitted into the system, the records that are in ESAT, be it the accreditation authority or the central gateway. So it's not about, again, auditing the finances of someone or something like that. It's only within the scope of ESAT. Next slide, please. So the subsystems. So I mentioned there are eight systems that play a role here. Some of them are already in place and others will have to be put in place. The first four are the ones that do not currently exist. The other four already exist and will only have to be upgraded to support functionality in ESAT in order to play the role. So the first two systems, the central gateway, we are considering that the central gateway will have to put in place two interfaces, a web portal and an API. The functionality will be the same. The intention here is to offer an option for the contract parties to use either of those. The for example, contract parties that are think of them as small entities, they rely on a RACIS service provider to run most of the technical functions that you normally associate with a registry. And they simply manage the business side of the a given TLD. They may want to just use the web portal. And in that web portal, they will, for example, look at the requests, make a determination and say, yes, this is approved or this is not approved, and et cetera, et cetera. So, but there are others that are a big portfolio TLD owners, they have, I don't know, 200 and something TLDs, and maybe they want a solution in which they integrate their systems with the central gateway, as opposed to have a person or an army of people using a web portal. So for them, we think the central gateway will offer an API, and again, same functionality, and it will be the decision of the each contract party to use one or the other. The functionality will be the same. Accreditation authorities, and not the plural here, because again, the central accreditation authority or the governmental accreditation authorities, they are going to have to offer exactly the same interfaces. We're thinking that there has to be a web portal. This is the interface that will be used by requesters. So requesters will use the web portal to get accredited, to submit requests, to pay the bill, etc. And the accreditation authorities will need to have also an API that they will offer to to contract parties to authenticate requesters. They need, because the contract parties, which are the ones that are ultimately disclosing the data, they need a way to authenticate the requesters. And so they will be doing that. The contract parties will be doing the authentication, relying on the accreditation authorities, who are the ones that have the relationship with the requester, the user. So that will need to happen using an API, and there is more detail on that later. So on the ICANOR side, the existing ICANOR portal would need to be updated with the small things like, for example, adding a few compliance forms, complaints forms, sorry. So to have the ability to for people to alert us about potential abuse behavior by either contract parties or requesters, for example, for data subjects to request action on their data, etc. Then we have NSP. That's the system we use. We call that the naming systems portal. And that's the system that we currently offer to contract parties, to races and registrars. And so we think that will be that will have to be updated to, for example, integrate the new types of complaints that could be filed against contract parties and things like that. We don't think this would be a lot of work. Number seven, contract parties, they already are providing an RDAP service that has been in place for a couple of years now, since August 2019. That service will have to be upgraded to support authenticated users. So enable a user that has been approved to get a request. They go to the contract party directly. That's one of the requirements in the policy recommendations, that the interaction, the passing of the data, only happens between the requester and the contract party. There is no one in between. And so RDAP is the obvious choice there, and also something that the PDP working group noted when we asked them the question directly. Anyway, so the RDAP service need to be upgraded to allow for authentication of users and also to check that indeed the request has been authorized, and more on that, why a contract party that we need to do that. We have a slide on that. Finally, the requesters, they would need an RDAP client. They can use whatever RDAP client they want. But as some of you may know, ICANN already offers another web client, lookup.icann.org. So we intend to upgrade that one to provide this functionality to make life easier for requesters, so that they, they would only do a one-click thing and they will get the data for a request that they have already been approved. Things like that. So those are the systems that we are envisioning that will need to be in place for ESA to work. Next slide, please. So this is the a diagram of the different actors and subsystems, how they interact with each other. This is the the things that are already covered, how, for example, requesters, they are going to be talking to the accreditation authorities. They are the only point of contact regarding request handling. They use the web interface to talk with the accreditation authority, and the accreditation authority is who handles the accreditation and request submission, etc. They get email alerts from the accreditation authority, for example, when that request is approved, and things like that. And in the center, we have Central Gateway, who is in charge of routing the requests. Once it's received from the accreditation authority, who in turn receive it from the requester, the accreditation authority is merely intermediary to make, again, life simpler for the requester, so that they only need to interact with one party. So the Central Gateway, as you can see, is in the middle of everything. They are the ones that route things between all the different parties. I'm not going to go into more detail than what I already covered in the presentation so far. And of course, we have the counterparty. As you can see, the requester is talking directly with the counterparty once a request has been approved in order to get the data from the RDAP service. Next slide, please. So one, language support. So per recommendation, implementation guidance 3.5 in the policy recommendation, the Central Accreditation Authority will only support English for two things: the user interface and the disclosure requests and supporting documentation. So someone that wants to, a non-governmental natural or legal person, remember, they are the ones that are interfacing with the Central Accreditation Authority. They will need to interact using English, and this again, because of implementation guidance 3.5. And if you think about it, it's to be possible to have the interaction with the widest number of parties. Anyway, so English only for both the user interface and the disclosure request and supporting documentation. Now, for governmental entities, they will be using an intergovernmental organizations. They will be using the governmental accreditation authorities. For them, we are envisioning they will be free to support any other language for the user interface. They will be free to do so. And they may also support other languages for disclosure requests and supporting documentation, if and only if the relevant contract party also has signaled that they support that other language, something that is also based on the policy recommendations. So this, for example, will enable the Mexican cyber police. They are they obviously use Spanish, and they are interested in getting access to a certain domain name that is in, say, TLD that is based in Mexico, the registry or the RSP is based in Mexico, and they want to have access to that. And so they have so the registry perhaps has signaled that they also are able to support requests in Spanish, and so that way the interaction can work in Spanish between the Mexican cyber police with the RSP that is in Mexico that also supports Spanish. And that way they don't have to use a language that is not their own. But again, this is only the case for governmental entities and intergovernmental organizations dealing with contracted parties that have signaled to a Central Gateway, who in turn will make it available to the accreditation authorities, that they are willing to use other languages, support other languages for requests. Next slide, please. Next one. So, request for accreditation, this was already covered in a lot of detail during the previous webinar. I'm only going to mention again that requesters need to be accredited before submitting any request in ESAS. Their identity will be verified, They will need to periodically renew that accreditation. And we're envisioning that they could use electronic IDs if they have one. If not, the identification will be done manually. And they can also use specific credentials in ESAT, say a user password or a certificate, whatever details are decided later in how that authentication can work. So let's leave it at that for now. Next slide, please. So another key point here is in the policy recommendation, there is a discussion of an element called the sign assertion. And here we divide that element. When we were working design, we realized that we needed to divide that in a couple of things. And one is when a requester is declaring that they have certain information or certain key element that needs to be verified. So for example, if a requester says, I have a trademark, so they need to have, they are declaring they have a trademark and that needs to be verified. So we are thinking that the accreditation authorities are going to be in charge of verifying those declarations. And once a declaration has been verified, it will be available for the requester to use in any given request where they deem is relevant. So for example, if they are requesting data that is related to a trademark they own and they have already a declaration that has been verified, then they can use that. And that's the sign assertion that you actually end up using submitted to the central gateway in that specific request. At the time of launch, we're envisioning that the governmental accreditation authorities need to support two types of declaration, verified declarations, and those are described in recommendation 941 and 942. They are related to automated processing. The first one is related to requests from law enforcement in local or otherwise applicable jurisdictions that have a confirmed GDPR lawful basis or processing to be carried out under GDPR Article 2 exception. That's one that needs to be verified by governmental accreditation authorities. The other one is the 942, the investigation of an infringement of the data protection legislation allegedly committed by ICANN or contract parties affecting the registrant. So again, that will have to be supported by governmental accreditation authorities. In regards to the Central Accreditation Authority, we think they need to support at the start the declarations related to trademark ownership. And of course, in the future, there may be new declarations that need to be supported. Next slide, please. Fifth, there is a webinar in December where there is going to be a detailed discussion about here. I'm not talking about what the fees will be or anything like that, just the type of fees that are envisioned per the policy recommendation and the design. As you may remember, the DESA is a cost recovery, has a cost recovery approach, and the type of fees that we are envisioning will be one for accreditation, so the cost of verifying someone's identity and the systems and processes that are around that. A second type of fee would be one related to verifying a requester declaration. So if someone says I own this trademark, there has to be some costs. A cost will be incurred in order to verify that that's indeed the case. And so that's a second type of fee. Third type of fee is the one about the processing of a disclosure request. There is potentially a cost to processing a request, so that has to be recovered some way. That's another fee. And I should add that this last one particularly is being still investigated by our legal department. There may be some issues in how that is set up. There is going to be more on that in the next webinar or in the future. And lastly, the billing, as I mentioned earlier, is going to be performed by the accreditation authorities, both the Central Accreditation Authority and the governmental accreditation authorities, and they will transfer the money to the central gateway, the relevant portion that affects the, for example, the cost of their request processing, because the other two costs, the other two fees are related to costs incurred by the accreditation authorities. And of course, governmental accreditation authorities, may decide not to charge fees for the things related to their own things like accreditation or request for declaration. That's their prerogative. But in regards to disclosure request processing, that's something that they will still need to manage the billing for and transfer the money to the central cable. So with this, I'm going to pass the baton to Eduardo to talk about some of the main processes that we discover in this design. So Eduardo is director of technical services, so he's my colleague in that team, and so he's going to be talking about this process. Eduardo?
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Can we go to the next slide, please? So for the actual non-public registration data disclosure process, we want to just explain a little bit that the proposed design basically splits this process into three asynchronous steps that we see in this slide right now. First is when the accredited requester submits the data disclosure request to the accreditation authority. Then the second step is where the contracted party reviews the request and then communicates the determination to the central gateway after receiving that request. And then the third one is if the request is for data disclosure is approved, then the requester would proceed to obtain the data from the contracted party's RDAP service. Next slide, please. To break down these steps a little bit further, the first step about submitting the data disclosure request breaks down into the next process flow. It starts by the accredited requester submitting the request to the accreditation authority by filling out a form, providing all of the necessary details of the disclosure request, which we will describe it a little bit in the next slide. Then the accreditation authority will proceed to validate the request. And then if it's considered to be complete and fully valid after verifying that it's the accredited requester, that it received the domain names for the data disclosure, the identity has been verified as well as declarations, the purpose and legal basis, then it proceeds to relate the disclosure request to the central gateway for proper routing. The next step involves the central gateway verifying the disclosure request against the criteria for automated processing, which is described in recommendation 9.4. We're gonna describe these scenarios a little bit in the next slide. And then the last step is when the central gateway notifies the contracted party about the new disclosure request that has been received. So we're gonna look into this a little bit more in the next slide. Can we move forward, please? Thank you. As I was saying before, when submitting the non-public registration data disclosure request, we will need the accredited requester to provide at least the information that is shown in this slide. It needs to include the domain name or domain names explicitly, meaning it has to be the fully specified domain names for data disclosure. It will also have to specify which are the non-public fields that are being requested. For this, we're planning on relying on the RFC 8982, which is the extension for the RDAP protocol for partial responses. The requester will need to provide the purpose and legal basis of the request, set the priority, which is also defined in the recommendations of the final report, which can be either urgent request or related to ICANN administrative proceedings, or just any other request. This will also have an impact on the response times target. The requester will also need to provide the supporting documentation for the request if relevant. It will also need to include details about the requester identity, at least it's the name, the organization, and the country and territory or jurisdiction. And then any requests or declarations that have been verified by the accreditation authority, if applicable. So these these declarations will be transmitted to the central gateway once verified in the form of JSON Web Tokens or signed assertions. And lastly, there's the element of the confidentiality classification, which is where a requester may indicate that the disclosure request should remain confidential from the data subject, and that will be for the contracted party to consider in the review process. Next slide, please. So one of the elements that was considered in the design was from the recommendation 5.1, which gives the central gateway the option to implement a recommendation engine. So it can tell contracted parties whether to approve or deny disclosure requests based on historical patterns that have based on historical patterns from previous disclosure requests that have been received in the system. But for the purposes of the ODA, the design does not consider having the recommendation engine at launch. This is a component that would need additional development, and then as well as time for training and learning to provide accurate recommendations. But what we did consider that some of the advantages of having this component working is that it could serve as guidance to standardize the contracted parties review process if the recommendation is used as reference. On the other side, some of the disadvantages is it definitely has an impact on the cost of this ESAT system, and the recommendations, since the contracted parties are not required to follow these recommendations, the value varies between contracted parties. Some may pay no attention to it, some may review this more thoroughly. So there's no guarantee that it will actually add the value that we would hope. Next slide, please. With regards to automation of disclosure request processing, the design is initially limits the scope for automation to the four scenarios listed in recommendation 9.4 from the final report. Four scenarios include basically requests from law enforcement in applicable jurisdiction for confirmed GDPR lawful basis, or processing to be carried out under a GDPR Article 2 exemption. The second scenario is investigation of infringement of data protection legislation allegedly committed by ICANN or contracted parties impacting domain registrant. The third scenario is when the disclosure request involves the city field only of the domain contact, to evaluate whether to pursue a claim or for statistical purposes. And the last scenario is where no personal data exists in the registration record and has been previously been disclosed by the contracted party. So in the proposed design, there will be no other scenario supported for automated processing, at least not without incorporating that through system development. But that would be subject to review by the GNSO Standing Committee, which is also another element describing the recommendations. But of course, this does not prevent contracted parties from automating how they process disclosure requests on their end based on their own policies or applicable law. Next slide, please. So it's important to note that for these automated processing, there's also exceptions that can be requested by contracted parties. So they can do so for any of the specific categories from the four scenarios I just described from recommendation 9.4. For example, if they find it to be not legally permissible for their own applicable law, or there's a significant risk, this is also from the recommendations, they can do so through the central gateway and just request an exemption so that disclosure requests that fall under this category will not be considered for automated processing. But they must provide the supporting documentation for review by the ICANN organization. And based on this review, these exemptions might be reversed as well. This is also from recommendation 9.5. Additionally, contracted parties may also opt out from automated processing based on specific either domain names. For example, if data subject has objected to automated processing, they may indicate the central gateway that requests received for a specific domain name or domain names may not be processed automatically. So that will always default to manual review by the contracted party. Or for example, if they request an exemption or opt out to request coming from specific jurisdiction based on the requester, that is also considered in the design. Next slide, please. So to summarize the automation of disclosure requests, basically we're going to have the four scenarios that we described from recommendation 9.4, which will be considered to be automatically approved by the central gateway unless there has been an exception requested by the contracted party for the automated processing, or the contracted party has previously opted out of automated processing for the relevant domain name, or the request comes from requestor from a specific jurisdiction for which the contracted party has also opted out for automated processing, or for example, the requestor has been sanctioned for any sort of abuse where their request may no longer be considered for automated processing. That's also a scenario that would exclude the automated processing within the central gateway as for it to be relayed to the contracted party. All of the other, any of the exemptions or opt-out scenarios will be relayed to the contracted party for manual review. But if not, and they fall into the four scenarios that we described from a recommendation 9.4, then this would be considered for automated approval of the disclosure request. These also, specific to one of the scenarios, for automation that we described earlier, which is the fourth scenario where domain names do not include personal data and have been disclosed by contracted parties before. This is also one of the, that's where it becomes relevant in one of these scenarios, where the contracted party must notify the central gateway whether this domain name is meeting this criteria or it no longer meets it so that it can be properly classified by the central gateway. Next slide, please. So in terms of disclosure request routing by the central gateway, once the request is received and the criteria for automation has been evaluated, then the central gateway will notify the contracted party via email, and it will also make available the information through a pull request through the API. So the contracted party can find out that this notification has been received. By default, this request will go to the sponsoring registrar of the domain names, except in cases where we're talking about a thick registration. So that would exclude thin registries where the registry does not have any contact information, or when the requester specifically asks the request to be sent to the registry operator, or for some reason the registrar RDAP service is not available. To clarify about the polling of messages, so this would be similar to what we have, for example, in the EPP model, where the registry makes messages available to the registrars, but it's up to the registrar to check up or poll the server to see if they're having new notifications for them to process. Next slide, please. So the next asynchronous step, the first one was about submitting the disclosure request and routing it to the corresponding contracted party. Then comes about the review process by the contracted party, which goes through the workflow we see in the screen right now. The first step is where the contracted party receives the disclosure request from the central gateway. Then the contracted party proceeds to review the disclosure request to make a determination. Now, this can be it's expected to happen when the disclosure request is falls in for manual processing. If it's automated, it's just for the contracted party to add into the records, but there's not really a review process expected here. In the case of a manual process, it can also be the determination that it needs additional information from the requester. That can also be the part of the notification that the contracted party will be sending to the central gateway. So it could be either approving the request, denying the request, or requesting additional information from the requester. And then once the central gateway receives that determination from the contracted party, then it relays that determination to the accreditation authority, who would be notifying the requester. Next slide, please. So as Francisco was mentioning before, in terms of the integration of the contracted party with the central gateway, there are two options. It would be available through a web portal for contracted parties that prefer to interact it through a graphical user interface. This is sort of expected for lower transaction volumes and more manual follow-up, or it can also be supported through an API. For contracted parties that prefer more automated integration between the systems, or if the processing volume is much larger in terms of receipt requests. Next slide, please. The retrieval process of the disclosure request, the contracted parties would be able to get from the central gateway all of the details from the disclosure request, which we saw in the previous slide. It will also receive an indication if the criteria for automated processing was met or not. And if it gets implemented into the future, it would include a recommendation to approve or deny their request. But as we said earlier at the start, this would not be part of the design. For requests that do meet the criteria for automated processing, the contract party, as I said before, does not really need to take any further action at this step. Next slide, please. So the actual determination, we do want to highlight that in the design and ask, according to the recommendations, the contracted parties remain the sole authorizers of the data disclosure request directed at them for their manual reviews. And even for automated, given that they are given the chance to opt out or request exceptions, so they remain the sole authorizers of whether to disclose data or not, even if it's on the automated, through the automated mechanism, if it meets under those four scenarios that we've discussed. For those that have been reviewed manually, the contracted party must still notify the central gateway so that it can be processed and send the corresponding notification. So it would relay the determination, as I was saying before, it's either approved, denied, or follow up for additional information. And then the contracted party may also indicate if the request has been approved because the domain name registration does not include any personal data. This also helps enable the central gateway from tracking when this fourth automation scenario is met or not for future disclosure requests. Next slide, please. Once the request has been reviewed, in the case of approved request, then the third asynchronous step goes on to this workflow we see now. This is where the accredited requester would send authenticated query to the contracted party's RDAP service to receive the registration data. The RDAP service would authenticate the requester by redirecting that request to the accreditation authority. Then the requester or the end user interacts with the accreditation authority to complete the authentication process. Then once authentication is successful, the RDAP service verifies the authorization through the central gateway, again through the API. To make sure that there's indeed an approved disclosure request for the authenticated user, for the list of requested data, and so on. And then if all of that is successful, then the RDAP service provides the response with the approved data and then notifies the central gateway that the actual disclosure already took place. Next slide, please. In terms of authentication and authorization, which are the two middle steps that we just mentioned, so we're basing the design on the supporting federated authentication of the requester using the OpenID Connect protocol. It's based on the technical model that was proposed by the technical study group in the past. It basically list the RDAP service operators to receive the request for non-public data requesting authentication. The accreditation authorities would then provide the user authentication service. Then the central gateway would act to confirm whether the authorization was provided by the contracted party or not. And then the requestors are the part where after sending the authenticated request, then they would receive the approved non-public data only if both steps were successful previously. Next slide, please. To support this, there are some added requirements for the RDAP service operated by contracted parties. I mean, this is, of course, subject to further discussion, as this is only the first proposal on the design. But it would need to support the, additionally, in addition to the base RDAP standards that are already need to be supported, it would also need to support this ongoing draft that is being developed in the IETF for federated authentication for RDAP using OpenID Connect. It would also need to be add support for RFC 8982, which is the RDAP partial response. And we would need to agree and define the field subsets that need to be supported by contracted parties. And we would also need updates into the GTLD RDAP profile that the RDAP service will need to support. Next slide, please. So next is for requester and contracted parties compliance enforcement. I think I'll pass the baton to my colleague, I believe it's Jonathan, or is this Francisco? I think it's for Jonathan, next slide.
Yeah, thanks, I'll take it. We can go next. So the SSAT abuse investigator is, that we mentioned earlier, is responsible for monitoring of standard operation metrics, monitoring requester compliance with the SSAD terms of service, verifying abuse reports that come from contracted parties or data subjects or just the public, and providing a requester's redress mechanism as referenced in recommendation 13.1.3. And the compliance side is responsible for investigating the contracted party's potential abusive behavior in SSAD and escalating non-compliance with SLA. We kind of went over the compliance function during the last presentation. But this kind of helps distinguish where the two actors are separate. I know some of the questions earlier were with, you know, in regard to these two subjects, but yeah, basically compliance, just dealing with the contracted party behavior, essentially the, you know, requesters could allege that contracted parties are not following the procedural requirements. The term abuse is used kind of in that context in the recommendations. But ultimately, the allegations of abuse are pertaining to procedural issues. So, as we stated before, there could be, you know, complaint forms that created for the requesters to file those kinds of complaints. Regarding the SLAs, there's the potential for automating any complaints you know, issues that concern SLA response times for contracted parties. We'll go next. Graduated penalties may be determined by the abuse investigator as a result of abusive behavior in SSAD, such as some examples here, rate limiting of allowed disclosure requests, exclusion from automated processing of disclosure requests, suspension, revocation for the requester's accreditation, and then requesters can actually appeal the penalizations, and the abuse investigator would review those. So next. For audits, basically they'll be performed by an independent auditor. And the idea is that there'd be kind of an audit before operation, just to make sure everything's in line, followed by yearly audits based on previous audit results. Essentially, you know, taking the lessons learned from previous audits and ensuring that those are still being addressed. The scope here is requesters, central accreditation authority, and then you can see there the country, territory, governmental accreditation authorities. Much of the audit information will be derived from logging in the system. So, you know, obviously auditing a requester would sound tricky, but there should be sufficient information within the system to audit the requester's actions there. It's based on documentation provided to the central authority and the central gateway. And the audit of the central accreditation authority will actually also kind of see within that the accreditation authority's audits of the identity providers. So it's kind of subsumed into that process. And then for the idea for the country territories is that they can basically have the option of using their own auditors or potentially going with a third party designated by ICANN. So next. That's it for me.
Thank you, Jonathan. Last section of the presentation. Next slide, please. In terms of the service level requirements that for the system, we are envisioning for the systems, I should say, we're envisioning that both the Central Gateway and the Central Accreditation Authority systems will need to meet the following service level requirements. In terms of availability, we are considering 99, so 99.9% system availability. I think that comes down to a few hours of downtime per year allowed. And in terms of response time, we are proposing to have 4 seconds for 95% of the queries on a monthly basis. And in terms of customer support in English for both the Central Gateway and the Accreditation Authority, the Central Accreditation Authority, it will be 24/7, so available all the time, but only in English. As a reminder, the Central Accreditation Authority deals with requesters, the non-governmental requesters, be it natural or legal persons. Central Gateway interacts with contract parties, accreditation authorities, and ICANN org, so it makes sense to limit the customer support to only English, besides what the policy recommendations already say. Next slide. In terms of system login and data retention, we are expecting that all the subservice providers in ESA to have login procedures that involves the central and the governmental accreditation authorities, the central gateway, and the contract parties. We are expecting to have a data retention policy to preserve all operational data and system logs for a total of 18 months. This is because of what my colleague JD Jonathan covered regarding audits, that we are intended to have an annual audit period. And so we are adding a buffer of 6 months, and that's why we come down to 18 months for the data retention policy for all the parties involved in providing some subservice within ESA. Next slide. In terms of reporting, this comes directly from recommendation 17 of the policy recommendation. the intention is to have quarterly reports that will be published in ICANN.org, providing details regarding the number of disclosure requests, approved, denied, automated, manual, etc., the purposes and justifications at a high level without, of course, disclosing any team sensitive or personal data. Response times also, information also about financial sustainability of ESAT, since this is a system that is supposed to be working on a cost recovery basis. Also per recommendation 17, any new guidance or jurisprudence that is received, if any, will be also shared. Technical or system difficulties and any other operational system enhancements that are made to the system will be also shared on a quarterly basis, published on ICANN.org. With this, I pass the baton to my colleague, Yuko.
Thank you, Francisco, Jonathan, and Eduardo. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Actually, Francisco, this is still you. The community feedback, or I can cover it. So we posed two questions to the community in terms of today's presentation. So first one is, did we capture all the necessary actions as outlined in the recommendations for accreditation, submitting disclosure requests, and routing them to contracted parties? Are there any actors or subsystems missing from this model, or roles and responsibilities not identified that you think should be included? So these are the two questions that we want to ask for community feedback. As previously stated, that you know this is a lot of information to digest, so you may not have an immediate reaction or statement, feedback, input. So if you can think of it later, you can always submit it through our publicly archived emailing list. But if you have reaction right now, Q&A pod is available. I believe that we have been pretty good at answering all the questions. We have many questions, and we've answered about 33 questions by now. And we have three open questions. So perhaps, can we turn it to Luna to read it out loud for yes. Remaining questions?
Happy to. So the first one is, the question is from Susan Payne. I may well be misunderstanding, but is this system being set up so the requester has to basically submit its request twice, once to have it reviewed for whether the registrar will disclose then? If they get notified that disclosure will be made, then they have to make a new request? That's the first question.
I can take that one. This is Francisco. No, the request is only submitted once, and then it's it's filed with the accreditation authority, who then passes it to the central gateway, and then to the contracting party, who makes then the final decision whether the request is approved or not. Assuming it's a manual processing, that is, and then the requester is notified that they got approved, supposing they were approved, of course, they also be notified if they were not approved. But if they were approved, then what they do is submit an RDAP request, an RDAP query, not the processing request again, and that they do directly with the contracting party. This is in order to comply with the policy recommendation that requires the data to only be shared between or only be passed between the contract party and the requester. This is also, by the way, how a modified version of how things work in the TSG. The intention here is to make it as easy as possible, for example, by providing a URL that can be used in with the RDAP web client if people want to use that, or they can put it in their own RDAP client and get the data as easily as possible. in that way. Thank you.
Thank you, Francisco. The next question is from Steve Crocker. What is the 4-second response measuring? Is it the time from when the requester submits the request to when the requester receives the final response? Or is measuring only the time the central gateway takes to put the request on its output queue?
Thank you, Steve. So Francisco again. So I think this is referring to slide 38 in regards to the service level requirements for the Central Accreditation Authority and the Central Gateway. So that is the response time for those specific systems. This is not the SLA for the request processing. There is an SLA for request processing that is described in the policy recommendations. I think it's recommendation 10. And those are in terms of days, except for automated requests. For non-automated requests, I believe it's 5 days in at the beginning, the first year or so, and then later 10 days, something like that. It's in the order of days, the SLA for processing requests. The SLA that we're talking about in slide 38 is merely regarding those specific systems. So if I am a contracted party and I'm doing a transaction with the central gateway, the central gateway has to respond to me within 4 seconds for 95% of the requests. And similarly, if I am a requester and I'm doing something with Central Accreditation Authority, or a contracted party for the matter, because they also interact with the Accreditation Authority, the SLA for the service level requirement for those interactions need to happen within 4 seconds for 95% of the query. So those 4 seconds is not the service level requirement for the request that is covered in the policy recommendations and recommendation number 10, to be precise. Thanks.
Thank you, Francisco. The last question is from Jan Janssen. Question, the ODP team is not in line with the carefully deliberated definitions of the EPDP report. Why is the ODP team redefining the terms accreditation authorities and central gateway and introducing a lot of confusion? Would a rewording not have been a more obvious and better choice? And this is not the last question, sorry. Francisco, will you be taking this?
Yes. I don't think we have published yet definitions. The ODA will be, which we intend to publish early next year, will have those definitions. When we were designing the system, took a careful look into the various pieces, the policy recommendations, et cetera. But I think more detail on that will be available to anyone interested when we publish the ODA. What we are presenting here were merely slides. We try to make it easier to understand, so we may be taking some shortcuts, if you like, in how we are presenting things. Anyway, I think more detail will be upcoming next year when we present the ODA. Thanks.
Thank you, Francisco. The next question is from Siva. Since there are multiple contracted parties, what happens if one of the contracted parties is approached with a direct request from a powerful requester, who in this case chooses to go out of the SSAD process, which he might find inconvenient? Isn't this one of the hazards of designing this essentially as a system between the contracted party and the requester? Yuko or Francisco?
Sure, I can take this.
Thank you.
So requesters are not limited to requesting the data in SSAD only. They always will have a freedom to go directly to the contracted party. So that's how SSAD is envisioned. And contracted party is the one ultimately deciding whether to disclose the data or not, whether it comes through SSAD or otherwise.
Thank you, Yuko. And I think that's it for our questions. Back to you, Yuko.
Okay, so I think we have just completed Q&A. I want to make sure that everybody has some time to sort of digest this. But in the meantime, I want to talk about what's next. So what's next is that first and foremost, we would very much appreciate your feedback. So knowing that we shared a lot of information today, we completely understand that if you have some thoughts later today or tomorrow, so if you can think of anything, please do send us an email. Email address is shown here, odp-sad@icann.org. This is publicly archived mailing list, so it will be obviously visible to everybody. Also, you will soon see a new blog post summarizing today's session. And as previously mentioned, we will be hosting another webinar in December about cost and fees. We should be announcing the date and time near future. So that's what's next. And I do see a couple more questions popping up. So let's get back into answering them.
Thank you, Yuko. Right. So the question here is, how does ICANN intend to resolve ambiguity in recommendation 9.1 around who gets to determine whether it is technically and commercially feasible and legally permissible to automate responses? And this is from Brian King. Who would like to take it?
I can do that.
Thank you.
I mean, the ambiguity is not about the recommendation. If you would say it's an ambiguity, if I understand the question correctly, it's not even ambiguity in the law. I think the fair question to that one is actually to say that if it's up to the contracted parties, because they have the legal responsibility for the balancing test, where I know that I'm simplifying the sort of answer. And so if they would like to delegate that legal responsibility to a system, that is something that is probably up to them and not up to the ICANN policymaking process in that sense. And I think it's important to remember that the asset itself has sort of the asset, and in the recommendation of the asset, is fairly clear that it is the contracting parties who makes that decision. They are the controllers of this, and that is not because what the policy making process cannot change that fundamental fact, because it's one of the more important parts of the actual law. And just to say that that's not a bug, that is the actual intention of the law. When the European Commission did propose this and decided to propose this to the European Parliament and the European Council, the member states, they made a balance between what the need for information and the right to privacy. And they came up, as we could see when it comes to GDPR, the protection of privacy is more important than for access for information. And we, there is a lot of legal testaments about that. The Data Protection Authorities has in writing confirmed that this is the right way to do it, and also that the NIS2 reconfirms that. So I would say, I know that there are many people on this call and other ones who would like to wish it is different, that the reality would be different. But I propose that you take that up with the legislator in the European Commission. We did try to change that. We did try to, for what we call the Strawberry Project, we asked the Commission to make ICANN legally responsible for the balancing test, to be data controllers for this. But unfortunately, we didn't get any traction on that one, despite good and hard work from many involved community members. The European Commission decided not to take that question to the data protection authorities. I think it's in general, it's important that the sort of, what is the problem, and then try to define the problem. The WHOIS systems were open before GDPR came around. Thank you.
Thank you, Oren. And the next question is, what is the expected timeline for completing the ODP? And this is from Jeff Newman. Yuko, would you like to take this?
Can I give a partly answer to that first, Jeff? One of the things the recommendation says is that we are going to, there's going to be a board interaction with the GNSO Council. That's a part of the interaction. And one of the things we're doing now is to set the timeline for that. And we hope that can happen, not that far away in the distant future, because we are getting to a place where I think that the question from the GNSO Council about the validity of doing this project versus the cost of it and the complexities of it is a good discussion to have between the board and the GNSO Council. So it's also a little bit depending on when we can set up that meeting. The internal work continues. And now we'll leave over to Joko.
Thank you, Oren. Thanks for your question, Jeff. So we have actually published the timeline during October's webinar number 3. During ICANN72, and that session deck is available on our webpage, ICANN.org/s.odp. Basically, it shows that the completion of the ODP as of right now to be in February 2022. And the team is almost done with all the draft, and internal review period will kick in soon. Thank you. Luna, if you're speaking, we can't hear you.
Apologies, sorry. My laptop just did a freeze. All right, so next, thank you, Yuko. Next question is from Susan Payne. Wasn't the optional recommendation from the Central Gateway envisaged as something that would help to inform future decisions to automate, i.e. if the gateway reaches the same decision as the CP 100% of times for a particular type of disclosure request, it would intend to provide comfort that such requests could reasonably be automated, wouldn't it? If so, what timeline is envisaged for providing this functionality? I think that's Francisco or Chris, perhaps.
Yes, I can take it. Thank you. Indeed, there is some value on the recommendation engine. We recognize that. I think Eduardo covered it in the when he was presenting on slide 21. So it certainly could help on guide standardized correct parties review process, but also there are some cons that is, of course, increase development costs for the system. Recommendation engines are complex to develop if they are not carefully designed, and they are, as far as we know, prone to both false negatives and false positives. This is something that we're still evaluating how to best approach this recommendation. But since it's something that is described as an optional element in the policy recommendation, and we are providing an assessment right now, we thought it would make sense to leave it out for now. And also it's worth to remember something Eduardo, I think, mentioned in his presentation. At the end of the day, this is only a recommendation that contract parties are free to not take. And so that also we thought weighed heavily on regarding the value of this tool. Thank you.
Thank you, Francisco.
Can I add to Francisco's answer? And again, potential automation is also the result of how to make the balancing test. It's up to the contracted parties are legally responsible for the balancing test, and I can or anyone else cannot decide how to automate or do anything, how they process that information internally. That would be against the sort of notion of the GDPR.
Thank you, Oren. The last question
actually,
so far.
Luna, if I may, we're 1 minute till the end of the time, so I think we should cut the Q&A portion here now. And Michael, I know that there's one pending question from you, and we would like to post our answer later on our webpage. So this concludes today's webinar. Thank you everybody for joining. I hope you have a good morning, afternoon, and evening.